Hello, welcome back to the show. And I'm very excited today to have a very special guest, David Murrow, who is the author of the landmark book, Why Men Hate Going to Church. Thanks for holding that up. I asked him to bring it because mine's Kindle. A lot of the books I are on a Kindle, it's not as exciting to hold up the Kindle, particularly since my Kindle is slashed up. So thanks for coming. I appreciate it.
It's great to be with you, Aaron. Thank you.
And there is a link to buy that book on Amazon in the show notes. And if you actually buy through that link, I get like 5 cents or something.
So I get 2 cents.
There you go. That's a way to do it. And if you haven't hit subscribe on YouTube yet, hit the subscribe button. And if you're not on the masculinist list yet, go to themasculinist.com and get on it. So again, David, thanks for joining. I probably read your book in 2012. Which I think may have been like right after a second edition or something came out. I'm not sure exactly how I found it. And I always like to say this was pre-Great Awakening, sort of really before I transformed my thinking about men's issues. But it was one of those sort of like pre-events that got me thinking, like, man, something's just off here in it. And then later that kind of congealed and I continued to refer back to it. So when was the book actually originally published?
The first edition came out in 2005 and was immediately reviewed in the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, really made quite a splash because it looked at a religious issue from a sociological perspective. My background is anthropology, so I didn't come at this as a pastor or a seminarian. I just held the church out and said, you know, what would an anthropologist say about what's going on as far as gender roles in the church? And then the revised issue that you're referring to came out in 2011.
Yeah. Well, I thought it was a great book. And again, it's still worth going back to today and looking. And even though it came out in 2005, you know, some of the stuff we'll talk about later on is I think you were actually prescient on some issues that people may have said, you know, may have pushed back on at the time, but now they're there. Did you pick the title yourself?
Went back and forth. My original version was Why Men Don't Go to Church. And my editor said, well, they go, but they don't like it. And so I wanted to use the word hate. He didn't like that word on a Christian book, but, you know, it really does describe the emotion that men, particularly younger men, feel when they think about going to church. You know, what's interesting is young men don't hate Jesus. They don't hate God. They don't even necessarily hate religious practices. What they hate is the mechanics of going to church, the ideas of organized religion, sitting in a row, sacramental sort of things. It's just meaningless to men in many cases, unless they themselves grew up religious. So that's one of the gaps we're having to deal with is this perception among men that it's unmanly to go to church.
Yeah. So I thought the title was great, to be quite honest, because it's like, I say it's simple, direct, masculine. It's everything you're talking about kind of encapsulated in the title. You know, none of this, oh, can't we all just get along? That nope, men hate going to church and what's going on with that. So how did you get interested in the topic again?
Well, as I said, my background is in anthropology, and I was sitting in church one Sunday, and my mind was drifting during a sermon. I know that never happens to you, but I began to fall back on my ethnographic training from college, and I looked at my church and asked, is this a matriarchy or a patriarchy? And I looked at all the symbols in the room, and there was quilts and flowers and banners and lace and ribbons. And I looked at the pastor, and he was wearing a robe and a multicolored stole, and he was speaking of love and beauty and relationships and nurturing and harmony. And then I looked at the volunteer opportunities in the bulletin, and it was for childcare and cooking and caring for the sick. And I looked around the room, and I counted noses, and over 60% of those noses had lipstick underneath. And I began to realize in that moment that our church was designed to enthrall and engage a woman with an empty nest, a 55 plus woman who wanted to stay busy, who wanted to have children in her arms. And everything about that institution was designed to thrill and enthrall her. And there was almost nothing to animate the heart of a young man.
Yeah, the quote that I took out of the book here, it says, no matter what the name on the outside, there are always more women on the inside The men who do show up for services often seem passive, bored, or uneasy. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I definitely sense some of that. It varies by church, but mm-hmm. what are kind of the stats? What is the ratios today, in terms of who attends?
Yeah. Well, when I did my original research, I found that the typical congregation in North America drew an adult crowd that was 61% female and 39% male. And it's important to understand that no other world religion has a gender gap even up close to this. Hinduism, Buddhism, Judaism, and of course, Islam draw a much closer to gender-balanced congregation. In fact, Mormons and Muslims, the two fastest-growing religions in America right now, are both male-heavy. Mm-hmm. So it's very important, if you want your church to grow, to draw in men, because once a church begins to... I always say this, once a church is 70% female, you can write its obituary. Mm-hmm. You cannot, the church is a two-winged bird. You need both masculine and feminine spirit. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have both, the church will either topple into legalism if it's too masculine, mm-hmm. or it'll topple into liberalism if it's too feminine.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, it really is, you know, what I've noticed is the real imbalance is in the single contribution. In fact, I often, this is one of the things that I look in when I go to a church, and I like to visit new churches and just check them out. How many single, like under 40 single men are there in the church? And some of these hardly any.
That's the real deficit. I don't have any hard numbers on that, but I can tell you an experience I had a few years ago. I spoke at a very large church in Oklahoma and asked all the young single men age 18 to 30 to stand up. Now, I probably spoke to 2,000 people that morning, and only 14 men stood up in two services.
Wow.
So if you contrast that with Jesus's disciples, probably 11 of the 12 were young single men age 18 to 30. So we've definitely changed from a guy-oriented religion to a grandma-oriented religion.
Yeah. You know, some of that changes, men get married and then they have kids and then a lot of times they go to church, but they are kind of a lot of ways dragged to church by their wives sometimes. One thing that I have definitely observed is for married couples, it's typically the woman who decides where the family goes to church. And therefore, where the tithe money goes. And if she gets unhappy for any reason, they're going to switch churches. I mean, it just seems to be the case. Men seem to kind of treat religion as like, well, that's kind of her gig. And this is even in conservative denominations. Like, that's kind of her thing. It's more her thing. It's more important for her to be happy than it is for me to be happy. So I'm just going to go along with what makes her maximally comfortable, where she gets engaged. And then again, if she has a falling out with somebody in the church, and it's like, okay, now we got to move.
You're right. In most families, the religion falls under the mother's portfolio. She takes care of the kids' education. She takes care of the medical, making sure the kids have their doctor's appointments. In a lot of families, a man would no sooner choose a church than choose drapes. It's just something that women do. And unfortunately, that causes the boys who grow up in these families, they can see that religion is mom's thing. Mm-hmm. And it causes great attrition as these boys reach 12, 13, 14, and they're desperate to prove their manhood. They're going to jettison religion because they've seen that it's mom's thing and not dad's.
Right. I did think, and I'm actually planning to write about this because I really feel that men do sort of like take certain elements of the household and say, that's my wife's fear, and I don't want to have anything to do with them. I mean, a lot of men, like, their wives even buy their clothes for them. Mm-hmm. They buy everything for them. And there was the famous Gillette ad that they did not long ago. They got a lot of pushback when it was sort of like toxic masculinity ad.
Yeah.
And one of the things I said is, probably women buy most of the shaving cream because most guys don't even, like, pick what shaving cream they buy. And when you sort of abdicate your responsibility to even make purchasing decisions for yourself, don't be surprised when this goes like directions, you don't want it to. So I certainly am a little bit on board with men are a little apathetic in some areas. I don't have the stats at the top of my head, but like women control the vast bulk of consumer spending in America.
Yeah, something like 80%. Yeah.
So it's this idea that men earn, money. There's this income gap. But when it comes to who spends the money in a household, You know, the wife is certainly in control or disproportionately influential in most of the spending. And I think that was one of my takeaways from the book was the primary customer segment that Christianity targets is women. And therefore, everything is designed to attract the women, and which then attracts more women. And again, what came first, the chicken or the egg? Did they serve the women because that's who was showing up, or did they choose it that way? But it does seem to be, I kind of looked at your book, especially you describe it anthropological. I kind of looked at it as a business school case study. You get all the statistics on the whole, here's who's listening to Christian radio, here's who doing this. And it's like, yeah, this is like Harvard Business School saying, yeah, they decided to target this particular, you know, women with kids demographic and the old, you know, these older women, there's like these female demographics that the church is really coming after that seems to disproportionately receive a lot of the attention because they are the people, they are the people consuming Christianity. They're the people buying all the Christian books, listening to the Christian music.
Yeah.
So in essence, they're just responding to the market. I do think there's some of that.
Well, there's a huge untapped or available market when women get an empty nest because they've suddenly got money, you know, because their husbands are probably, or, you know, they may have retired from work or their husbands may have a good income in their 50s. That's typically when we have peak earning power and they have no children to care for. Well, those maternal instincts don't go away. And I think, you know, good-hearted women redirect their maternal energies into the church. Through the nursery, through the youth group, through benevolences. And this is a good thing on its face. The danger comes when in the denominations that have female elders and leaders, they bring those maternal energies to the leadership of the church and they make grandma type decisions. Well, you know, there's this gay couple that wants to get married in our church. And I know what the Bible says, but they're just such lovely people. And, you know, Jesus would love them. He would say yes to their, you know, and so we get a softening of doctrine and, you know, from the kindest heartedness, you know, from the best motivation, wanting to be kind to people, doctrine softens. And then you go down the road to theological adventurism, liberalism, and then that's a death knell for your church because young families don't want to raise their children in a church that's theologically ambiguous. They're not looking for a youth leader who says, hey, you need to go out and experiment with your sexuality.
Right.
Or, hey, transgenderism is fantastic. You ought to try it. That's not the message most parents are looking for
when they're
looking for a church.
That's why a lot of people go back to church when they have kids, because they want their kids in kind of indoctrinated in traditional morality, basically.
Moral scruples. Yeah, even liberal, even the most liberal parents don't choose like transgender youth leaders. I ran a Google search for openly gay youth leader, transgender youth leader. I couldn't find anything. I couldn't find a single church in America, even among the, you know, the way out lefty, you know, churches. They're not, because parents won't put up with it. Parents are looking for moral certainty for their kids. They're looking for bedrock principles that they can build their lives on. And, you know, these squishy, ambiguous women-led churches, and they're almost all women-led, just don't stick with the rules. They stick with relationships.
Yeah. And I know it's not always the case that these churches are like that. You know, when I lived in New York, I visited Hillsong Church there a few times and they've had some challenges recently. But you know, they had five or six services a day, all packed. Sometimes you'd have to stand in line to get in. You have to sit in an overflow room. And, you know, I went to the 10 a.m. service, which I think might be their oldest congregation. It's like the one where you bring your parents from out of town, but the median earliest, age was like 24.
Yeah.
You know, I felt like, man, I shouldn't be here. They're going to try to, somebody's going to arrest me or something, especially instead of wearing a trench coat because it was raining.
Yeah.
And, you know, there were a lot of guys, there were a lot of single guys in there, very obviously it was overwhelmingly single. So some churches are, you know, attracting men, but you know, that's one of my barometers that I use. I've learned, some rules of thumb for like judging various aspects of a church. Like one of the things I've discovered is you can kind of position a church theologically just by listening to the announcements. If the announcements are primarily about service opportunities, it's a very liberal church. If it's primarily about internal church activities, it's a much more conservative church. Are they talking about Bible studies and stuff or stuff like that? Or are they talking about the soup kitchen? And so, you know, you're probably talking about both, but you could kind of like sense where people are on the spectrum just by that. And like, that's one thing I look at. Does this church have any younger single adult men in it? And, you know, there's this Lutheran church, you know, in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America by my apartment in New York. I went there one day. They have a great liturgy. They do all the Bach, you know, cantatas and the correct liturgy. I mean, they're really amazing. And it was actually a pretty well-patronized congregation, a lot of young families. Mm-hmm. But I look, man, I don't see any younger single men anywhere. Didn't see one. I'm like, so that tells you something is – there's something not healthy in the demographics, I think.
Yeah, well, I mean, liberal churches believe that we transform the world and that transforms hearts. Evangelical churches, we transform hearts and that transforms the world. It's that we both believe the same things. It's a question of which is primary, which comes first. So I think that's what you're describing, that you can tell the church's theology by whether they're focused on transforming individual hearts, which is the more evangelical approach, or are they out doing world transformation through good works? You know, I think for men, particularly young men, and you've read all the mythopoetic literature and, you know, Iron John and all that stuff. Okay. There is a process through which young men have to die and be reborn. Mm-hmm. And that's the heart transformation. That's why evangelical churches, particularly mega churches that focus on heart transformation first, are much more appealing to young men than these older churches that are focused solely on good works. Because a young man's greatest need is to be transformed from a boy into a man, from an irresponsible child into a responsible man. Mm-hmm. And so churches that preach that sort of message, you can be born again, are much more appealing to those than say, hey, we just need to go out and do a soup kitchen.
Mm-hmm. What are your great lines? You quote somebody in the book. You say, you know, a wise Texan once told me, men don't go to church because they've been. And I thought that was a good one. And so I want to talk a little bit about some of the attributes that you flag as turnoffs to men in church. And I'll start with the music. You mentioned K-Love, like the radio network. Tell us about K-Love.
Well, a few years back, I had a chance to interview the program director at K-Love, and he openly admitted that 67% of their listeners were female, and just 33 were male, among adults, that is. You can't account for boys who are strapped in the back of the minivan. They don't count. Mm-hmm. But among adults, it was two-thirds women. Up to 85% of the Christian products are bought by women. Over 80% of the non-ordained staff in church, that would be church secretaries, lay staff and stuff, are female. So yeah, there's definitely, you know, men may have the pulpit, they may control the what we would call the upper echelon or the highest leadership positions of the church, but they are generals leading an army of women.
Yeah, you know, when I've listened to some K-Love, and to me, it's like light rock love songs to Jesus.
Yeah.
And I actually do think that kind of Christian music, light rock music, and country music, because country pop music, are all made by the same people in Nashville. You know, it's like the same group of people. They're all sort of the exact same song. There's just a few tweaks on them in terms of what they are.
You know, I'll jump in there. You know, it's not just K-Love. It's many Christian radios use a liner that sounds something like this: "Safe for the whole family."
Mm-hmm.
That's their tagline. That's their marketing promise: "Safe for the whole family." And, you know, and boys, it's just poisoning boys' hearts because you know they're driving around in the backseat of the minivan year after year, listening to their mom playing K-Love on the radio or whatever the local Christian radio station, talking about how safe Christianity is. Now, that's wonderful for mom, because what does she want for her children? The whole reason she's driving a minivan with 16 airbags is because she's into safety, right?
Right.
What a boy is into when they're 13 and 14 years old. I mean, we're planting this time bomb in their hearts that the moment they get to that age where they want to throw safety to the wind, for 13 years, they've been sitting in the back of the van hearing how safe Christianity is.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're just telling them, please reject this, because this is all about your mom. And this is not about you. Christianity is a car seat. It's something that keeps you safe. And boy, that is absolutely the wrong message to be teaching to young men.
Yeah. I mean, you just listen to these songs and these lyrics. Like, there's this one Hillsong tune. It's "The Greatest of All Romance," they call it. These are like literal love songs to Jesus. And like, you can take a lot of the Hillsong ones, for example. You take a song like "Oceans," listen to it without any words. I mean, if there was no words in it,
just read the
listening to the tune, you would think this is like this is some kind of a love song or a ballad. And I even go back, you know, the to, I think it was in the 70s when Debbie Boone had this song, You Light Up My Life, that was a love song that a lot of Christians used as sort of a worship song. And I think it was like, even back then, it's like, this is the exact same, it is. It's like, how many guys want to be singing, you know, love songs to Jesus like that? They're the same ones that, you know, you're listening to from like Delilah or something like that.
Well, I put it this way, you know, hymns, traditional hymns often led us onto the battlefield. Praise and worship leads us into the bedroom.
Right. It's not a mighty fortress is our God anymore, you know?
Well, but you know, to give the songwriters credit, I think this is slowly beginning to change. I'm noticing a lot fewer romantic allusions. And I think this might be because of the work I'm doing at Church for Men. I've just been blogging and talking about this, and I've been on some worship blogs and stuff. And a lot of worship leaders, even Matt Redman, came back and said, you know, that line, "I'm so in love with you." He says, if I had to rewrite that now, I would say, "God, I'm so in awe of you," because that more accurately describes our relation to God. And so, and speaking of relationship, you know, what's the number one metaphor that Christians use to describe discipleship today? A personal relationship with Jesus Christ. Now, who's more into relationships, men or women? Obviously, women are. Women buy magazines about relationships. They watch movies about relationships. Hey, who's dating who? I mean, women are just way more interested in that stuff than men are. So when we describe the gospel as a passionate, intimate relationship with a man who is totally into you, I think we're definitely appealing more to the female demographic than the male.
Yeah, to be sure. Now, you mentioned you got a lot of reviews. I wasn't there when the book first came out. What was the reaction or the response to the book?
You know, it's been surprisingly positive. You know, I think there is a realization among many churchgoers that something is wrong here. We've had a lot of support from women with mothers of young men who are seeing their boys turning away from the church at age 10, 11, 12, 13. They really want to know, you know, what is it about church that is driving young men away? I'll give you a positive and negative about children growing up in church. Right now, the Sunday school is undergoing a complete transformation for the better. And churches like my own church here in Anchorage, Alaska, are leading the way. They've changed the name of Sunday school to Adventureland. They do a lot more kinetic activities, more running around the room, more hands-on activities, hands-on lessons, object lessons. The boys really like it. Now, what's interesting is youth group is becoming less boy-friendly. Youth group used to be, you know, the three G's, games, goofiness, and God. Lots of pizza, pie in the face, silly stuff. But then there'd be, you know, the serious times as well. This is the youth group that I grew up with that led me to faith in Jesus, because we had fun, but then we got down to business with the Bible. Today's youth group is almost exclusively a sitting still type experience. There's a lot of singing. And the reason we sing so much in youth group is because we have these youth praise bands now. Youth leaders have figured out they can involve six or eight kids by creating a band. And so they find the more artistic.
I think Hillsong did that too. That was one of the things Hillsong did.
They find they scoop up the more artistic type boys who knit their own hats and put them in the band. And, you know, coffee culture type boys. There's nothing wrong with these boys, but they're not going to get the jock boys in the door with 30 minutes of singing love songs to Jesus. So youth group is becoming a very sedentary, talky, singy, emotional type experience. So we're losing a lot of boys there. And studies have shown that by age of 18, or by the end of youth groups have 21% more girls than boys in participation. So they have set the stage for the female-heavy church of the future by age 18.
You know, when you were talking about some of these changes to Sunday school, you know what it reminded me a little bit of the muscular Christianity movement. And, you know, I always tell people, look, this idea that, like, I've discovered anything about the female skew of Christianity, that's not true. This has been something that's been discussed probably going back to, like, the dawn of industrialization. I do think industrialization caused people to start talking about a crisis of manhood because it seems like things are dangling. You know, muscular Christianity, you know, did a lot of good, but it was ultimately an ineffective movement. So I'm kind of wondering how, you know, are we kind of repeating some of the same things that kind of didn't work last time?
No, I'm going to push back on you. I think muscular Christianity is the reason Christianity is so strong today. Mm-hmm. And what you're referring to is a movement that came out of the Victorian era, when America and England began to industrialize and people began gathering in cities and stopped working on farms, there began to become a softening of men. And that softening was very apparent in the churches. We had a feminization of the clergy. We had large numbers of men abandoning church to work in mines, mills, and factories. They were too tired or they were gone on Sundays. And so they were separated from their families and they became separated from the church. And so this issue became a huge area of concern. And so we saw the founding of organizations like the YMCA, the Young Men's Christian Association, in London in 1844. And YMCA actually coined the term bodybuilding. They wanted to bring a more masculine feel to the gospel. And then the YMCA spread like wildfire through America. In the 1920s, the YMCA was the single largest hotelier in the United States. They put up so many men right before, after the war and before the Depression. And then we also saw the founding of organizations like the Boy Scouts of America in 1905 over in England. And so, and you know, church camps. There were no church camps until the muscular Christianity movement said, you know, we need to get boys and kids out into nature again because they're trapped in these cities. And so what's interesting is that the largest proponents of muscular Christianity were the mainline denominations, Presbyterians, Methodists, Episcopalians, etc. The churches that have completely feminized today were actually very man-oriented. After World War II, it was very fashionable for men to return from the theater of war and join one of these churches that had baptized themselves in the gospel of men. And those churches grew like wildfire. They drove
the 50s was the high watermark of church attendance in the United States.
Right. And the high water was the mainline, the liberal mainline. Mm-hmm. They weren't liberal then. They had gone through the muscular Christianity movement. They had the church camps. They had the men's retreats. They had Boy Scout troops at camps. I mean, they were guy oriented. But then in the 1970s, feminism came in. They brought in female elders and leaders and pastors. And that just washed that away in a generation. And the men left. They left religion to the women. They said, hey, you gals, you've got that. I'm going to go play golf. Mm-hmm. And we see the huge declines since then. So was muscular Christianity a success? Maybe not in its own, not to its own credit, but I believe a lot of the church infrastructure and the growth that we enjoy today was undergirded by the efforts of those men back in the 1800s and early 1900s.
You know, you talk a lot about like the mainline churches, and obviously you're a conservative. But I remember one of the things I remember from reading, it struck me the very first time in the second edition, is you mentioned, I think it was this woman who was a Methodist pastor who had read your book and was making some changes to try to make her church more male friendly. And you were getting some grief. You were getting some grief from people that like you were helping some of these churches like attract men. And I think you took an interesting point. Like, look, I'm not here to sell one denomination or another. I'm helping to try to get more men in church. But it looked like some people kind of gave you some flack for it. You know, what kind of pushback did you get in some of these cases?
I told her story to shame the male pastors, actually. I said, if a 5'2" female pastor can bring men into the church and bring church growth with it, why can't you do it, buddy? Mm-hmm. I wasn't doing that as an advocate. I wasn't, you know, advocating, hey, women pastors are the greatest. Mm-hmm. I was just simply saying that, you know, if a woman can do this, you can do it. And so, and my hope, you know, I was born and raised in the mainline church. I was a Lutheran as a child, went to a Presbyterian church, served as an elder on a Presbyterian board of elders for a Presbyterian church, the session. And, you know, my heart is still grieved that the direction these churches are going. And I think if there were more masculine presence, more focus on mission instead of relationships, more focus on the rules of the Bible, and being willing to say no to people, less codependence with people in need or, you know, different pressure groups and stuff that we've seen since the men have left the governing boards. So that, you know, that's my dog in this fight. I'm not trying to say that, you know, we should have women pastors or shouldn't have them. I'm just trying to say that if a woman can do this, so can the men. And if a mainline church can reach men, anyone can.
Great. Well, once again, people, for those of you who've joined in, I'm talking with David Murrow, author of the book, Why Men Hate Going to Church. And you can see a link to buy it in the show notes. It's a great book. It was really, I think, as you mentioned, it was a landmark. When it came out, the New York Times, people were paying attention to this because it really hit a nerve. And, you know, it seems like there were some attempts to respond to this kind of men in the church through different ministries that mm-hmm. came along. And I get a lot of these were yeah. before my day. Mm-hmm. But it seems like, so the Promise Keepers were the most mm-hmm. famous one.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, and then they crashed and burned. So what happened with kind of men's ministries, you know, over the period when you were kind of writing and getting engaged in this book?
Promise Keepers crashed and burned in 1998 because of a fateful decision to stop charging admission to the events. The thinking was, if we lower the barriers to entry, we'll allow more impoverished men, because it was a lot of, you know, middle class and upper class men driving for us country. And there was thought that if we take the admission away, we'll get more men. The exact opposite happened. Once they took the admission fee away, attendance imploded. And this, they learned something about men, a valuable lesson. If you don't charge a man something, he won't put any value on it. Mm-hmm. Whenever I do a men's course, I charge $10, and it's a nominal amount. But once a man lays his money down, he'll be there. And I say, hey, it's $10. If you make all 5 sessions, I give you your money back. A little aside there. What's happened in men's ministry since then? We haven't had as many high profile men's ministries, but there's been a lot more foment, a lot more voices speaking mm-hmm. into the men's space. Guys like Tony Evans. I served on the board of the National Coalition of Ministries to Men. We have over 100 organizations that are out there doing ministry to men. So it's still happening. And by the way, Promise Keepers is going to have their first stadium, full-size stadium rally in over a decade, July 16th and 17th, 2021 at AT&T Stadium in Dallas. So Promise Keepers is coming back with one large stadium event. So, you know, we'll see how it goes. I don't think we can judge the health of men's ministry based on large events. I think the real strength of men's ministry is how many guys are getting together for coffee and Bible study at Denny's or Panera Bread on a Saturday morning. How many young men are being discipled by the older men? There's a great new program called Better Man, where older men actually gather up a small group of men and disciple them through this video curriculum. And they absolutely will not proceed until each group has a mentor, a guy my age or up, you know, in his 50s, 60s, or 70s, who wants to invest in men. So, yeah, there is actually a lot of good activity going on in the men's ministry sphere. It may not be as high profile as it was during the Promise Keepers movement, but ministry to men is proceeding.
You know, one of the things I observed that I think got very wrong in men's ministries and the church's approach to men. I may come back with a little different approach than you on this is, the church seems to have gotten this idea along the way that the way you reach men is to be the drill sergeant, you know, and it's like it's gonna be like Full Metal Jacket. We're gonna get in your face. Men want to be challenged, but in fact, all they do is sort of beat men up all day. Mm-hmm. You know, man up. Because how many man up sessions have there been? And it's like, you know, here's how you're screwing up so bad. And yeah. You know, the Promise Keepers seem, the predicate of the Promise Keepers seem to be that, like, well, you know, men aren't keeping their promises and all this. And I say, well, wait a minute, you know, women, you know, initiate 70% of all divorces, but the church never has and never will have a ministry urging women to keep their promises. I always like to say, why does anybody ever tell women to keep their promises? I do think there's this sense in which the church has basically been very, very negative. Even the people who were like famous for reaching men, like Mark Driscoll, he had this famous "How dare you" rant. He's going on and on and on, tearing men up. You know, Matt Chandler ranting about boys who can shave. It does seem to me that they've really haven't. And I just look at how bad the church has done at reaching men, and I look at what Jordan Peterson's doing great. You know, Joe Rogan's doing great. There's a lot of people out there that are doing great. And who are challenging, like, you know, Peterson is challenging men in ways, but he's not just like blaming them for all the world's problems. You can tell he actually cares about these people and wants to build them up. It just seems to me that the church has really kind of never quite figured out how to crack the code on doing ministry to men.
My view on that is men do need the man up conversation, but it needs to come one-on-one from someone they trust. It doesn't need to be berating them from the pulpit.
Right. In front of your wife and kids.
yeah. Let me emasculate you in front of your wife and kids. No. I mean, I agree with you. Even on Father's Day, you know, we get beat up. Mothers are lionized. Men are challenged. So, there is a place. I mean, there is a place for those man up conversations. But I do agree with you. I think the church has been too harsh on men, not encouraging enough. And, you know, Peterson, he's definitely, he definitely connects with men, because not because he necessarily takes men's side, but because he's understanding toward the challenges that men face. Mm-hmm. And I think that's been, you know, he's talking about the issues that men feel but don't have any forum to speak of. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why he has been a success, and where maybe some reasons some of the church efforts have failed.
Yeah, I mean, if I would kind of be embarrassed. I mean, here's a guy that sold, you know, 3 million books and like selling out places. Like, what's going on? And, you know, now I personally find that a lot of these self-help guys, self-improvement people, they don't resonate with me necessarily, because so much of their shtick, and Peterson is a little bit less this way, but somewhat is this way. It's like, mm-hmm. it's all about relying on the self. You take a guy like Anthony Robbins, Awaken the Giant Within. That's what.
Yeah.
Now, I think Robbins actually has a predominantly female audience. I mean, the people that I've known who've been really into. So it's interesting to see which of these people are got, you know, attract the women, which is versus who attracts the men. There's got to be some like academic studies on that. But, you know, it is interesting to me. The other thing, and this is where I want to get into some of the stuff that was super prescient in your book. Is you make the argument, you know, as I recall that you framed it, as men really put a premium on excellence. Mm-hmm. And most church services are just not that excellent. and that you said, look, these mega churches are getting it right, because the mega churches are the ones that are excellent, and they have the best production values and the best quality speaking. How does excellence play into this?
Well, churches, we know how and why churches grow. 85% of church growth is driven by personal invitation. I call my friend up. Hey, you want to go with me? Mm-hmm. Almost none of it's walk-in. It's all, and especially when it comes to new Christians, 85% is personal invitation. Now, if I attend First Podunk Church with my 80 worshipers and the bad music and the kind of so-so sermon, I'm not going to invite my friend to that. If I attend 16,000 member mega church, I know the music's going to be great. I know the sermon is going to be off the charts. I know the food service afterward is going to be excellent. I know everything, you know, the campus is going to be clean. It's going to be an impressive facility. Now, these things sound so carnal, right? They're so unspiritual. But all you're doing is you're setting a table for a man to think, if I invite my friend, I won't be embarrassed. And so that's been the secret sauce of the mega churches. Everything is done with excellence. Men not only enjoy those things, but they feel confident inviting their friends to enjoy those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I've noticed like the average, you know, pastor, the average sermon's pretty mediocre, quite frankly. It's not necessarily great. The content isn't even necessarily that great. The presentation's not that great. But you go start looking at these top people, man. I mean, they're world-class. I speak in front of audiences, you know, quite a bit. And so I'm an above-average public speaker. But now I went to the Gospel Coalition's conference this year. It's because it's here in Indiana. I live in Indianapolis. They have it here, you know, every time. And I'm like, man, these people are like top 1% speakers. They are really, really good. I mean, you can see they've been coached. You know, they've been scripted. They got the perfect audio-visual down. They've got all the marketing, but it's like, this is like, I say it's like world-class marketing. Like this grade production. And these guys are super good.
They're craftsmen. You know, it's not these sort of sermons just don't just happen. And one of the secrets is they've been relieved of their chaplaincy duties. Mm-hmm. In a small church of 80 people, a pastor might have to visit 4 people in the hospital that week. He might have to counsel 3 couples in crisis. Mm-hmm. You know, he doesn't have time to put in 30 hours and create all these wonderful visuals like Andy Stanley does, who's got a staff to manage that for him.
Right. And a professional PhD level research assistants and all the people behind them, that it's like the politician, when they walk out on stage, it's not just them. These people have got like people. These are people who have people.
Right. Right. Yeah. So, you know, I'm trying to be sympathetic to the guy with the 80-person church. Right. You know, I understand your travail. I know what you're up against. But even so, you know, even if that's just the small church that you operate, you can still include an engaging object lesson. Mm-hmm. We have to understand, especially now that so much preaching is on video. Video is television. Mm-hmm. Pastors don't use visuals because they don't trust them. They weren't taught how to use them. They think that it's a gimmick. It's not. I mean, if you look at Jesus's teaching, half of his lessons either include a some sort of an actual physical visual, or mm-hmm. they're built around some sort of a metaphorical object. You mm-hmm. know, pastors have, even the busiest pastor can up his game and increase his viewership and his impact both in the room and on camera by including more visual elements. And so that's one of the things I'm starting to do, is I'm starting to work with pastors, coach them into how to become better visual communicator, because I work in the TV business. That's my day job. So mm-hmm. a little ad there for what I'll be doing.
Yeah. So just I got some comments from the audience. I'm going to try to get to these questions before the end. One of them from John here: do churches, mega churches, have much higher men's participation?
The gender gap in a typical, as I said in the introduction, the typical North American church draws an adult crowd that's 61% female. In most mega churches, it's close to 50-50. It's hard to completely close the gender gap, because as men flood into the church, women flood in faster. I often say mm-hmm. there's nothing more attractive to a godly woman than a godly man. And mm-hmm. women love worshiping in the presence of men who are not just there with their hands in their pockets, mm-hmm. but men with a smile on their face, men who are being transformed by the love of God. That's a very attractive and comforting thing to women. So it's hard to gender balance the church, because women come in faster.
Yeah. When I first read this book and I was sharing with it, some of my pastor at the time, he was very negative, because one of the things that you kind of predict in there is like, look, there might be like, and I may be getting the number wrong, there are going to be like 50 churches left in America by the time
200,
this is done. 200 churches. They're all going to be mega churches. It's going to be these top dog guys, and all these other churches are just going to go out of business. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I look at the landscape here in Indianapolis. There are a number of big multi-site mega churches, non-denominational mm-hmm. mega churches that kind of dominate it. There are actually mm-hmm. some very strong mainline churches left here, but mm-hmm. you know, that's kind of what's happening. You know, you got to go to a flagship mainline congregation, or you go to one of these like big mega churches. And I think people miss out there. They're saying you're advocating for this outcome, but this is sort of like where we're going, and this is where yeah. we were going. And it does seem to be that way.
No, just as Walmart wiped out Main Street, mega churches are going to wipe out the little church on the corner. And COVID is another factor in that. The shutdown of those churches, they may not have had the online tools necessary to reach their congregations. They may not have had online giving in place. So it's just going to be a very stressful time for that small church. Now, that's not to say that there aren't opportunities for small churches. As I said in the previous response, any pastor can become a more effective communicator both online and on screen, but they have to learn their craft. And pastors have to humble themselves and say, you know, it's not just me standing up waving a Bible for 40 minutes. Right. I have got to learn to connect with a visual culture. Right. And so I think, yeah, mega churches are putting smaller churches out of business, but there are also opportunities on the edges for individual pastors and small congregations to really make an impact through better teaching and through more effective ministry.
Yeah, I thought this was super prescient, because you were sort of writing this pre-internet, when kind of video streaming started taking on a life of its own, and now you have so many people who just attend church virtually. They may not even attend a church in their own city, and it's kind of strange. Like a lot of these one of the local mega churches here, they opened a new location near me, so I went to check it out, and during the sermon they said, hey, we're going to launch an official new campus that we call our virtual campus. And I think most of these mega churches now have an official like virtual campus pastor, because people are just coming in. You know, guys like Mark Driscoll, you know, we're just bringing in huge numbers of people through mm-hmm. video. And so now people are sort of like, I hate to say it, it is a little bit like the Second Timothy piece about finding the pastor will tickle your ears. You find a guy you like, he doesn't have to be in your town. I'm just going to watch him online. And then even if you go to a church locally, that guy's going to look like not so good, you know, compared to what you're seeing.
Well, and to their credit, I mean, these churches are deeply grieved that they have so many people online, and they are doing their best to minister to these people. That's what the virtual churches are about, these virtual campuses. They want to dedicate staff and volunteers to ministering to the people that they have online, who may be in Sri Lanka or Australia or whatever. Mm-hmm. Obviously, these folks are not going to attend a physical service. So God bless them. They're trying. Mm-hmm. But obviously, the best solution would be physical presence. People need people. They need to. If we've learned anything from masking in the last years, we need to see each other's faces.
Right.
And so, you know, I'm praying that there would be a huge revival of physical attendance. We're not seeing it yet. There still may be fears surrounding COVID or whatever. There's also the tendency, you know, that men have kind of a natural, I don't want to call it laziness, but I think if there's an easier way for a man to do things, he will opt for it. And mm-hmm. I think a lot of men have spent the last 16 months watching church in their pajamas. Mm-hmm. And they've realized how great it is not having to get the kids out the door and, you know, having to face all that stress. So I think it's going to be a harder sell to get men back into the house. But to all those men who are listening, it's worth the effort. It's worth right. the effort to be physically present with the body of Christ and not just watch it on TV.
Yeah. I mean, I think COVID, it's going to be interesting to see the results of that, because I know there have been there's a big resortation of people going on in the church. It seems to be driven to me. One, it was driven by COVID in the sense of who's meeting in person and who's not. Mm-hmm. And the churches that were meeting were drawing in people. The ones that were not lost some people. Then it was masks, whether you wanted to wear a mask or not, kind of a crazy issue. Yeah. And now right. kind of the whole woke thing is causing a bunch mm-hmm. of resortations. So I think it would be really interesting to see, what happens with that.
Yeah. I'd like to see it too. I really don't, I haven't seen any new numbers. I just know that in-person attendance, what's interesting, in-person attendance has fallen, but giving hasn't.
Right.
There's a lot of churches, I mean, the vast majority of churches have not seen a dip in giving, and that may be the trillions of stimulus dollars that are being pumped into the economy. I don't know if that's a long-term trend, but people are continuing to support their congregations financially, all but the smallest ones.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's a good sign. I mean, it says that people, where your money is, there your heart will be. Yeah. So Christians' hearts are still with their churches, so that's a very good sign.
Got a question here from Thomas. He says, this comes across as seeker-friendly. And I guess, you know, again, the knock, I think that maybe where he's getting at is, you know, the knock on a lot of these mega churches is, you know, they're great. They got a model to get people in the door, welcome them, but it's very theologically light. And, mm-hmm. you know, Willow Creek famously did all these surveys, and they were always yeah. unhappy that they were not getting the kind of development and discipleship that they aspired to, for example. You know, how would you respond to that?
You know, I think megachurches are all across the theological spectrum. It's not an area. My main area is focusing on getting people into the pews. Once they're there, it's up to the church to deal with them. So, you know, I really don't have a lot of expertise in that area. I really can't comment extensively on that.
Yeah. Well, I think part of it is we're just a little bit talking about what is happening. And that's where I do think there is this idea. It's like, I'm not designing the system I would prefer. I'm kind of like saying this is what's actually been going on. And we have to, like, we can't just pretend that, you know, like people going to their you know, preferred pastor guru over the internet is not happening. That's like a real, like a real trend.
I mean, just to comment on what you were saying, you know, the commentary says this comes across as seeker friendly. You know, it's like I said before, we do need to continually have hard conversations with people about sin in their lives. But it's not necessarily wise to blast them from the pulpit about their sins. Those conversations, especially with men, need to come from a trusted mentor or someone who is discipling them. That's really the deficit. It's not that the pulpit isn't forceful enough about condemning sin. I think the pulpit needs to be welcoming, but then there needs to be a process whereby individuals can mentor one another and say, look, you need to get that sin out of your life. And that's proven to be the most effective model. You know, we live in a very sensitive culture right now. Unfortunately, people are not used to hearing about their sin and their deficits. And so if you just get up there and blast away at you know, those blah, 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 blahs, you know, you're probably going to drive more people away than you will get. You remember, we're fishing for men. We're not catching them. We're not preaching to the saints in the aquarium. Right. So.
All right. Well, we're going to try to limit this for an hour. So what I want to do is I want to ask one more question about a great passage in the book, and I'm going to try to take a few of these questions that came in from the audience. One of the things that you did this test where you took two lists of attributes and you asked people, which one of these best represents Jesus? So where did you get these attributes from?
Well, I'm going to actually give the test. Why not, huh? Yeah. Okay, so this is on page 7 of my book. Sorry, I have to put my glasses on.
Yeah.
So I have two sets of values, and I'm going to read the first set. It's competence, power, efficiency. Which set best represents the values of Jesus? Okay, so as you're listening to these values, think, okay, which one is more like Jesus? Set A is competence, power, efficiency, achievement, skills, proving oneself, results, accomplishment, objects, goal orientation, self-sufficiency, success, and competition. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's set A. Set B is love, communication, beauty, relationships, support, help, nurturing, feelings, sharing, relating, community, loving cooperation, and personal expression. Now, I've given this, every time I give a talk, live talk, I've read these sets of values to the audience. And whether that audience is men or women, Christian or non-Christian, secular, whatever, always people are more comfortable with that second set, love, communication, beauty, relationships. When they think of Jesus, they think of those values. And then I tell them where they come from. They're from chapter 2 of the book, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. And the first set are the values of Mars, the values that naturally come to men. And the second set, everyone's comfortable with assigning to Jesus, are the feminine values that come from Venus. Mm. So you can see right away, we have this perception, whether we're male or female, godly or not, we have this perception we are more comfortable assigning feminine values to Jesus. And so you can see right away the problem we're dealing with is that men perceive Christianity as something that is womanly. And we've got to overcome that and help them to understand that no, yeah. Christianity is a manly path. It's not a womanly path.
Right. I always love it. You take some set of data or some criteria, something that was developed for one purpose, and then use it somewhere else and see what you get with it. So I thought that was really, I thought that was really interesting. So I want to try to get to some of these questions and comments here. Michael just said, as a younger man myself, I can tell you the reason Jordan Peterson appeals to me more than many Christian voices is because he speaks more about real life than abstract theology. Mm-hmm. So I thought that's an interesting,
good comment.
Interesting one. Mm-hmm. And then we had a commenter named Grant that says, I ran a men's fish fry. It had more men at it than at Sunday morning service. Mm-hmm. And you know, basically the church said, by the way, we're not going to pay for this. We're not going to fund what you're doing. But he went on. So I think that was interesting. Let me scroll back.
Well, Grant, let me say, Grant, you've got bigger fish to fry.
Ta-da.
Sorry.
Okay, let me see what I can find. Here's another question about Jordan Peterson from Bert. Do you think Jordan Peterson's mythical reading of the Bible is responsible for some of his resonance? Is biblical literalism less resonant with young men for some reason? I guess it's a great question. Yes. I don't know the answer.
I probably don't either, but I think you're on the right track, Bert. I think, you know, we have this postmodern society. There is no objective truth. You know, mm-hmm. it's how men are raised. And so sometimes you have to kind of, if you're fishing for men, you've got to kind of put that lure out. Let's be a little uncertain. You know, let's look into the mysteries of the Bible. At some point, you've got to say, no, this is how it is. You know, but I think you can kind of lure them in a little bit with being a little more, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I think mythical or mythopoetic, mm-hmm. you know, 20 years ago, John Eldridge wrote the best-selling Christian men's book of all time, Wild at Heart. Mm-hmm. And he talked about mythopoetic archetypes.
Right.
Peterson is also into archetypes. And I think archetypes are tremendously helpful mm-hmm. in reaching young men in particular.
Right. Then, I got one here from Foff. I think maybe the username coming through is, could teaching about the brave men throughout church history help this issue? Have you seen anything on that?
You know, I was there's interesting. There's an old book called Fox's Book of Martyrs. It's been around for hundreds of years. And I've often wondered if what would happen if somebody used that as a youth group curriculum, for example, focus on how much you're going to suffer if you keep coming to youth group. I had a youth leader who told us once, I remember this from when I was 16, he said, Christianity, properly practiced, will result in your death.
Hmm.
There is no other way this ends. Mm-hmm. And boy, I came out of there thinking, yeah, let's do it. Let's do this. I mean, every young man has that death wish. We want to do something that is truly challenging. And, you know, so, yeah, I think there might be some value in that.
Yeah. You mentioned Fox's Books of Martyrs was like the second or third best-selling book for like the longest time. It was unbelievable. It was right up with the Bible, Pilgrim's Progress, and then like Fox's Books of Martyrs. And
right.
It's a book most people have never heard of today.
Yeah, the guys, DC Talk a few years ago did a book called Jesus Freaks, and it was all about the martyrs in the church. It was kind of an updated version of Fox's book, and sold really well among young men. So yeah, I think telling the stories, you know, that's one thing the Catholics do very well that Protestants don't, is tell the story of the saints, the heroes of the faith who stood up for the faith often at the cost of their own lives.
Got another comment here on Peterson. It says, counterintuitively, the mythical reading draws more meaning and implications from the text than the exegesis of people who claim to really believe it.
You got some smart listeners here. Exegesis? Yeah, big one.
That's right. There you go. got a question from Greg. Would beefing up the Lord's table as the central feast of Sunday worship, not just as an add-in, engage men?
Well, that would speak to Catholicism again, which is focused on the Eucharist, and Catholicism is not packing men in. So I'm not sure making it the central act of worship. I would suggest a more robust celebration of the Lord's table. Use real bread, real wine for the adults. Or just make it an after. I always thought that it would be cool to do a shorter service and then adjourn for an actual meal, making the Eucharist part of that meal. So yeah. I mean, there's a lots of room for experimentation in that area, and you know, I would encourage pastors, church planters, to try making the Lord's Supper something a more robust experience than a little teeny cracker and a little teeny glass of Welch's.
Yeah, we know it is interesting that I went to this mega church here that will be remain nameless. That was the one that opened a new location, and they were talking about their virtual campus. And I was walking in, and there's this box. And, you know, my wife, she thought it was like party favors or whatever, and it was the little communion, prepackaged communion. And we kind of laughed, and now everybody's using that on account of COVID. Like, everybody switched to that. But one thing I will say that I have observed is, there has definitely been a swing back towards more liturgical, sacramental practices in these churches. I mean, even Russell Moore, who is, a big shot in the SBC until recently, in his book, he's like, we ought to be celebrating communion every week. And I'm like, that's practically heresy for a Southern Baptist, quarterly communion, best not sell it. So I think there is, I think there is something to it. There, which is interesting. And then I just had somebody from Gerard that Voices of the Martyrs has an updated version of Fox's Book of Martyrs. Somebody again, Bert again, the prepackaged communion, a great artifact of 2020. You should put that in a time capsule. And see what happens. David, thank you so much. I appreciate you being game to take questions from the audience, for coming to show the book. Again, you should hold the book up. It's Why Men Hate Going to Church. A second edition now from 2011, still very relevant. And again, I think some of it around the megachurch stuff, and the more people going to the top people, the power law distribution has been very prescient. So check it out. Again, there's a link to buy in the show notes. And again, subscribe. Hit the subscribe button on YouTube. And make sure you subscribe to the Masculinist newsletter at themasculinist.com if you haven't already. And David, before we go, is there anything you're doing now new that you want to plug? I'm kind of plugging the old stuff. We always want to make sure we plug the new album, sort of thing.
Yeah, a couple of things real quick. My latest book is called Drowning in Screen Time. And so this is an issue with men. Especially in post-pandemic, a lot of men have lost their families over their obsessions with pornography, video gaming, etc. This is a path back to health. So I encourage men to pick that up. And then another thing is, because I've worked in the television business for the last 40 years, I'm going to be launching a cohort of pastors. I'm going to be personally training pastors in how to become better visual communicators so that you can create an online audience that actually reaches more men. You don't have to be the guy with the 30,000 and the big fancy cameras. I'm going to be teaching you techniques that will make you a better communicator, both in the room and on screen. I don't have a name for it yet, but I'll be rolling that out in the third or fourth quarter of this year.
Great. I'd love to see it. I need more. I always say I need more voice coaching. I need more, video coaching. There's a lot to be like, I'm not ashamed of saying, time to take some coaching when there's things, you didn't know about. Because, it's not like everybody's, you think these guys are all naturals, but I'm like, pretty much they've all had great coaching too. So good luck with that. Again, thank you very much, David. I appreciate you joining.
Yeah, it's been my pleasure. Thank you, Aaron.